My name is Mike Elgin, and this is my Food and Technology podcast number 23. My guest this week is author and journalist David Sachs. Here comes the FatCast. Now that everything's digital, connected, automated, and efficient, what are we missing from the analog world? My guest today wrote an entire book called The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. Here's my conversation with David Sachs. Thank you so much for coming on the FatCast. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm also a fan of, well, we'll get to what else I'm a fan of. I discovered in preparing for this interview that, in fact, you wrote one of my favorite articles ever, but we'll get to that. Now, your most recent book, The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter, really struck a chord with me because I love physical things, especially physical books and newspapers. Absolutely love them. Of course, digital media are, you know, so much cheaper, they're more practical, they're more useful, they're supposed to be better for the environment. So why do we love physical things?
Well, I think fundamentally because we're physical creatures, right? We still interact with the world sort of at its most richest and rewarding when we're able to touch and feel and smell and pick things up. And while the convenience that you mention of all sorts of sort of digital information and goods and ideas is kind of its main advantage, I think we underestimated just how much the sort of tactile functions of analog experiences meant to us.
It's kind of really interesting. I cover social media, and one of the big trends now is fake news on social media, and everybody's in a panic about it. Facebook is freaking out, trying to figure out how they can change their algorithms so that people aren't spreading false news. Nobody knows what's true anymore. We're entering post-truth politics because of fake news and because it's digital and being passed around on social media. And it seems to me that the solution is for people to simply subscribe to reputable physical newspapers and magazines. You know, try to cross this political spectrum, maybe a left-wing publication, maybe a right-wing publication, and just read on paper. Like, it seems like we had solved this problem, and now we have created a problem for ourselves out of nowhere for no reason. Why do you think there's societal pressure to dismiss physical news media as antiquated?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, I think that, look, you can have fake news and propaganda in the analog world. You know, the Der Stürmer, which was the Nazi Party paper, and, you know, the Dearborn Independent, which was the virulent, you know, anti-Semitic paper of you know, funded by Henry Ford, the Breitbart of its day. Yeah. I mean, those were paper publications. I think the difference is, you know, paper has a cost, right? Publishing something has a cost. It requires a bit of a machine behind it of editors and fact checkers. And so there is a sort of a minimum standard that you know, clears a certain hurdle. It doesn't mean you can't have lies and half-truths and falsehoods and propaganda in paper. It's just somewhat more difficult. And especially now when, you know, the paper publications are sort of almost seen as a luxury or choice, those who are choosing them are doing so, you know, electing that sort of quality. But, you know, there is sort of fundamentally this idea of economics, right? And it's this, I think, somewhat false notion that, you know, the main, you know, problem of print is the paper itself. And if you get rid of that, then you know, then the business makes sense. But what you've seen is that so many publications have sort of followed that path and put all their articles online for free. And it's not like the riches have then come to them. If anything, they've created more problems. They've given away their product without actually replacing it with any revenue. So I think, you know, what you're seeing now is this kind of shaking out between, you know, the promise of digital publication, which hasn't necessarily come to fruition in terms of, you know, yeah, you can publish anything online, you can send it around, but you still, you know, very few people know how to actually make money off that. The resilience of a lot of paper media, which, you know, may be declining in readership and obviously in ad dollars, but still has a value there. And if anything, that value is now greater because it is, you know, it is a mark of quality. So even if you subscribe to the New York Times online, as I do. I don't subscribe to the paper edition or the Washington Post. You know, there is like a notion of quality because it also is something that's tied to a physical product, right?
Yeah.
And as someone who's a journalist for print magazines and newspapers sometimes, you know, I know that what that means in terms of the back end of how the stories are made, right? There is a greater accountability in terms of effort that the editors go through to make sure something is good and consistent and adheres to a certain standards of fact, that whenever I write for an online publication just isn't the same because it costs less. The idea is to get it out quicker, to do more of it. And so that has an impact, I think, on you know, the quality of the information that's there, you know, that the medium is the message in some way.
One of the things I like about physical newspapers over the digital is linearity. When I go to the New York Times website, you know, they're trying to cram all the different sections and the top stories from each of the sections. And they're also promoting their weekly magazine. And, you know, there's all this stuff all over the page. And I kind of, my eyes sort of glance over it and I'm like, well, I want to read this story, and then I want to read that story, and I'm just automatically creating a filter bubble. Whereas when I have the physical paper, I start on the front page and I go through and I consider every article in order. I don't read them all, but I see them. I see the headline and maybe the deck and maybe skim the lead. And even if it's something that I don't necessarily care about, other than the sports section, which I just throw away immediately, I still get a sense of it. I still am exposed to the fact that this stuff is happening. They cover stuff in African countries or Pacific islands that I, you know, just never penetrate the mainstream consciousness of people who are reading online and using filter bubbles. And so the linearity of physical media, I think, is one of its powers.
Yeah, there was an editor at the managing editor of The Economist that I interviewed for the book, his name's Tom Standage. And when we were talking in London, he said, you know, what we sell at The Economist, which is, you know, my subscription costs like close to $200 Canadian a year.
Pricey.
You know, I rarely get through an eighth of each issue because it comes every week. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm going through, I'm seeing what I want to read. But what he sells is finishability, which is that you can never finish the internet. There's always the next thing. There's always the next article. The New York Times is constantly refreshing its feed to show, you know, the latest and the greatest. And that's a great advantage. But, you know, there is something to that contained experience. And in some ways, you know, as you're saying, it does make you read things that you wouldn't normally read. You know, I just finished an Economist article from a while ago. It was, you know, in my bathroom where The Economist lives. And, you know, it was about, you know, a border town, you know, the tale of two border cities between North Korea and China and how, you know, one has evolved and the other hasn't. And it was just fascinating in the way it was told. Again, that's not something that I would ever click on the Economist website or the website of the New York Times, and certainly would never appear in a news feed I have because, you know, it didn't relate to the previous story I read. And that's the only way, you know, you get that feedback loop. But I think, you know, that is what people look for. And that's why, you know, people still subscribe to the New York Review of Books and still subscribe to the New Yorker and, you know, other magazines, and newspapers, you know, especially Sunday papers, because they're looking for that sort of immersive experience of saying, okay, I don't want to have to pick and choose, just present it to me. Tell me what I should be listening to, right? What I should be caring about. Whereas I think a couple of years ago, there was this great promise of, we're going to give you only what you're interested in. And I think now we're seeing both from the perspective of readers and media consumers, right? It's like, okay, well, you know, now I'm just getting a lot of the same, whether it's on the app of Spotify or on Netflix, right? Like, it's, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. But in the other sense is, you know, the political consequences of that, the societal consequences of only being shown the same thing again that you see in the mirror over and over has, you know, real world consequences.
Now, I'm Gen X, I guess. And I grew up with vinyl records and Polaroid cameras and other media objects that millennial hipsters now seek out of a sense of nostalgia. what's bizarre to me is, why is it that they are nostalgic for my past as opposed to their own?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily say they are seeking it out of a sense of nostalgia. Nostalgia certainly plays a part in it, and that depends on the individual and the technology. But in many ways, you know, these are people who are adopting these, you know, resurgent analog technologies that they never encountered in the first place.
Yeah.
And so it's very difficult to be nostalgic for something you didn't actually know. Certainly that's possible, and it may play some role, but I think, you know, they are largely adopting it as a new or sort of different experience to the digital norm. If you are someone who grew up in the 1990s, you know, the digital has been kind of the standard that you've adhered to your entire life. You know, kids who are in college today, I mean, they've grown up only knowing MP3s and downloading music and listening to music on Apple devices. I think about last summer to my friend's daughter, who was turning 9 years old, and for her birthday got a Fujifilm Instax camera, which is Fuji's, you know, version of the Polaroid camera, and they've been selling incredibly well, especially to younger consumers. You know, this was the gift that she had begged her parents for. She was so excited to have it. And this is a girl who, you know, had just turned nine. Her entire reference to photography throughout her whole life was iPhones and iPads. Like, taking a photo was a tap on a flat screen. That's always what it had been for her. There is zero nostalgia that played a role in her desire for that camera. It was just a cool thing. It was almost a new technology for her, right? Wow, I press a button and out comes a picture that, like, shows up in front of my eyes, and I could write on it, I can give it to a friend, I can put it with a thumbtack in my wall. That's cool, especially compared to this flat screen that, you know, all I can do is email it to people or put it on Instagram. And so I think, you know, it's a reframing of something that, you know, was old, but in many ways becomes new.
Literally a novelty.
Yeah.
So I'm a technology journalist, but I'm also a hardcore foodie. And this podcast talks about both food and technology. And some of the ideas for food technologies and startups being funded in Silicon Valley are absolutely horrible. Bloody veggie burgers, lab-grown meat, chickenless eggs, synthetic milk, fake coffee cubes, it goes on and on. You wrote one of my favorite New Yorker articles of all time, and this is what I was referring to earlier. I didn't know that you had written it until I was preparing for this interview. The article is called The Real Soylent Sickness, and it appeared in the October 17th issue. Can you summarize your point in that article?
Well, this was around the time that Soylent had come out with some sort of like energy bar, meal replacement bar versus their whatever liquid pablum that they usually sell.
Right.
And there'd been a rash of gastrointestinal
yes.
sickness from many of their customers. And you know, I was sort of wanted to attack the philosophy behind it, which is both Soylent and many of the sort of Silicon Valley food startups are aimed at saying, listen, there is a problem with food and we're going to engineer our way out of it. And, you know, this flies really against the real overarching trend and the more significant trend of the food world, especially in North America, of the past couple decades, which is, you know, a move away from highly engineered technological food and a willingness to return almost in, you know, a metaphorical similarity to the sort of return to analog of real food, of slow food, of, you know, look at the rise of artisan sourdough bakeries, look at the growth of organics and farmers market and local food. This is something that, you know, began maybe four decades ago and has consistently grown to the point where, you know, companies like McDonald's are saying, okay, we're not going to use, you know, caged eggs anymore. I mean, we're taking preservatives out of it. And the whole notion of kind of the biohacking of the food system by startups like Soylent and many others is this notion of, you know, it goes back to, like, you know, people pushing Tang as the solution to nutrients in the 1950s and to Wonder Bread, and the idea that we can engineer the perfect foods and therefore we'll all be able to live in our space colonies on Mars or whatever. And the reality is most of the stuff tastes like shit.
Yep.
and you know, I think it goes back to this idea of the end of the day, like, you know, perfection in food is not about is not an engineering problem. There is so much more we look for than the absolute perfect balance of calories. You know, there is pleasure in it. There is culture in it. There is history in it. There is bonding in it. And all of those things are not problems that need to be engineered away. They're things that need to be embraced. The more efficient a food is, the worse it's going to taste. The less efficient a food is, the better it's going to taste. You know, when I in the summer, you know, I used to live in Argentina, and so I ate a lot of, like, you know,
meat.
Wood-fired meat and steak, right? You know, so in the summer when I make a barbecue at my family's, you know, house that they have on a lake, you know, I'm, you know, it's a 3-hour affair of, like, building a fire, getting the coals, raking them down, slowly cooking the meat, turning it, being very temperamental, right? It's very inefficient. You know, could I cook that thing in an immersion circulator in a bag and then, like, precisely sear it at the precise thing? Yeah, but it wouldn't taste as good. It wouldn't be as fun. And I think there's, you know, if you want to jump to the metaphor of, like, the digital era, you know, digital technology excels at efficiency. But sometimes efficiency isn't what we need, and it isn't what we want.
Well, it depends on how you apply the efficiency. So the way I like to look at food technology is that there's food technology that modifies the food to make it a better product. Let's say you have a problem, which is that food spoils on the shelves and it's expensive because you have to throw away all this waste. So the solution is preservatives. You change what's in the food with technology, or, you know, an extreme case of that would be GMOs. But then you look at another way to be efficient with technology, and that is the rise in farm robots. So, for example, instead of genetically engineering crops to withstand incredibly toxic pesticides, you could have robots pulling the weeds 24/7. They never sleep. They just constantly pull weeds. What you're doing is you're using technology in order to not modify the food itself. And I love that kind of technology. And there's all kinds of examples of that. And we can go either way. And it's essentially a quiet war that's happening in the world of food technology about which direction we go in.
Right. And I think at the end of the day, you know, people's taste will win out.
The humanity, you know, we're hardwired to want to barbecue that meat for 3 hours.
And I think, you know, it is that fundamental thing of, you know, who would ever think that the sort of slow sourdough bread would be growing in prevalence as people want to eat less of the bagged sort of Wonder Bread stuff. I mean, in the 1950s, if you told people that in the food business, they'd say you're absolutely ludicrous.
Right.
And yet that's sort of what occurred, right? Because, you know, in the food world, you cannot sacrifice, you cannot make that change, that increase in efficiency, without sacrificing some sort of flavor or experience. And fundamentally, we want to eat better tasting food. So, you know, it's this interesting thing, because whenever you hear a TED Talk or some other version of, you know, wannabe TED Talk from, you know, these future of food incubators or startups, you know, it's always presenting these things in the rosiest way. And with this, we can, you know, end nutrition, you know, and starvation in Africa and all these sorts of problems, without ever addressing the fact of, well, is this actually what people want? Is this how people like to eat?
That was the big mistake in the mid 20th century when they said that in the future that food will come in pill form.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all, you know, based around this notion of, and then you can just work more. It's like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Yes. Wage slaves. Eating cubes.
Let's talk about delicatessens. You wrote a book called Save the Deli some years ago. Why do you love Jewish delicatessens?
I mean, it's just, it's a food that's very near to me. And you know, we grew up eating on a weekly basis in my family. And so I have a deep emotional personal connection. It also just tastes fantastic. And, you know, one of the things I talked about in that book, which was really interesting, which sort of flowed to this, was, again, that notion of, you know, technology in its own way, right? Of going, you know, when all the delis went from hand slicing the meat to slicing it by machine, when the meat got that much more processed, when, you know, places tried to standardize the flavor more. Yes, it was maybe ostensibly better for business, but in the long term, it actually was worse for it. It made the food taste worse, and the places that sort of adopted it didn't really necessarily last in the long term. And if you look at the delis that have not only survived, but the new ones that have opened up now and are thriving in many cities in North America, if not around the world, it is the place that embrace that kind of you know, imperfect, handmade, unique touch, because when someone goes for a pastrami sandwich or a corned beef sandwich, that's what they're seeking, right? They don't want, you know, the McDonald version of that. They want the real, you know, the homemade flavor and feeling of it. And I think it's the same with something like barbecue, for example, right? Could you do the most computerized, perfect smoker and have the real thing? Sure, you could. But like, if you go to the place in Nashville or Kansas City where, you know, they're cooking in a steel drum out back and shoveling, you know, splitting logs with an axe. I mean, that is as much as the taste is the way it actually tastes on your tongue.
Now, you wrote an article for The Atlantic, I think about 8 years ago, probably when you were writing or after you had written Save the Deli, about your frustration with finding good rye bread. And the name of the article was The Search for Real Rye. And I see your complaints about the bread that's available in delis as being part of a larger global ambiguity about bread, where even great restaurants serve horrible bread. And this is as true in Europe. I mean, Americans think, oh, in Europe, they have all this great bread. Well, yeah, you can find great bread in Europe, but most of the bread that most Europeans eat is total garbage. It's a lot like North America. Why did we as a species kind of lose the ability to make good bread?
I'm probably paraphrasing Michael Pollan here, but I think, again, it was this idea of efficiency, right? Economics. And there was real reasons behind that. I mean, the notion of, food scarcity and hunger drove research into yields of flour and ways of producing bread that were more efficient, that could deliver greater calories, that, again, would have preservatives so the bread would live longer on the shelf. But at every turn of that, you sacrificed something in the flavor and the texture of the bread. And, it's funny, like over the past couple of years, as I've gotten more into eating better bread, I have yet to actually try baking it. But eating sort of, sourdough, and as a number of places in Toronto have opened up that serve it. There's a great one called Blackbird Bakery, which is very close.
Yes. That's on my list, man. I can't wait to go there.
It's awesome. I am just like unable to eat that crap bread.
Yeah.
I cannot buy a loaf of it. It's almost like I haven't had McDonald's in a number of years. And then whenever I do, like a bachelor party or something at 3 a.m, I'm just like, what is this? Like, how did I ever eat this stuff? So I think, in many ways, to get back to the sort of technological aspect of stuff and what is driving that, people toward, analog, right? Like a 20-something-year-old who gets into bread baking is not, looking nostalgically at the way his grandmother made bread. He's able to sort of judge the merits of it on its own qualities and say, yeah, this isn't the most efficient advance, but this is the best. And I think, the process of technological evolution isn't just a straight linear line. Oh, the technology gets better and there everything gets better. Occasionally we need to reach back and examine whether the advantages that something, a new technology might bring are something that we're totally comfortable embracing, or whether we need to sort of alter that or bring in an older technology or an older method to balance things out. And so I think, with something like cooking, you need that. And you're seeing that balance struck in many interesting ways, and the debate's ongoing, but that's healthy, right? That's what allows us to have a fridge full of foods that don't all just spoil right away, but also some, good, interesting, delicious things in there too.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated with rye bread because I'm obsessed with naturally leavened bread, and rye bread can't be leavened with yeast if it's real rye dough. And so rye bread has to be a naturally leavened process. And in North America, rye bread is associated with delicatessens, and it's also associated with the caraway seeds they always add. And I've always wondered, that's always been a mystery to me. Do you know why? Where do we get this association between rye bread and caraway seeds?
I have no idea. I mean, I assume that there's some sort of, Eastern European something.
this is what happens with almost every food. Is in its place of origin, there are 1,000 varieties, and then when the immigrants come, like one or two of them sort of survive. Dominate,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So that's got to be what happened.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think it's a regional thing as well. There are certain cities where you'll see, or certain areas of the country where you'll see more caraway in sandwiches, you know, at the bread at Jewish delis, and other ones you won't. And you know, I have yet to look into it, and I don't necessarily know. I wish I could tell you.
Let me ask you something. In all that searching for real rye, did you find it?
You know, I found what I thought was the equivalent of it. I mean, I think it's a spectrum. You know, there are places that make, I'd say the place that makes the most sourdough like traditional rye, what the first place that I ever tasted it was Kenny and Zook's Delicatessen in Portland, Oregon, which is one of the pioneering, you know, artisan type delis on the continent. And yet, you know, if you compare it to like a Finnish rye bread or those really dense actual Russian rye breads from a Russian supermarket, it's a very different thing. It's still largely a traditional sort of sourdough white bread with a bit of rye flour put in there. So, you know, I think that there's a great spectrum of that, right? And look, you know, Katz's Deli is one of my favorite delis anywhere and has the most delicious pastrami sandwich, and their rye bread is terrible. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's really just,
you wrote about that in the article,
and rips and breaks and whatever, but you know, I'll take it for what's in between that. And then there are other places like Detroit where the rye breads are all really good, even if they're not, you know, so rye heavy. They're thicker, they have a better texture the way they produce it. They bake it twice so it has a thicker crust. But yeah, I know there are certain delis that have really gone sort of far on the route of going back to a sort of more traditional, naturally leavened rye. And in some cases, they haven't actually succeeded in making it something their customers want. And they've had to go to something that's a little more, a little whiter, because people are so used to, you know, classic deli rye as a frame of reference that a more sour, denser bread is just not what they're expecting.
Yeah, and it's also more unreliable. You can't, with naturally any natural leaven process, you can't exactly figure out what the timing is going to be. It's you kind of have to play it by ear. Whereas with yeast leavening, you can, and which again requires the addition of white flour or something else, some wheat flour.
Yeah,
you can schedule it down to the minute, and that works. Delis are intense manufacturing operations, if nothing else, where you can't just not have any rye bread.
No, definitely not. It would be a real disaster.
So David, let me ask you one last question. What's your next book going to be about? What are you working on?
Good question. I don't have one that's sort of set yet. I don't think it's going to be about food, at least the next one. So I'm not sure. I wish I could tell you.
All right. Well,
I'll let you know when I know.
Okay. David Sachs, I want to thank you so much for coming on the FatCast. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I will look forward to your next book, whatever it is.
Thank you so much.
Please email your ideas and feedback to mike@elgin.com. Thanks for listening to my weekly food and technology podcast. Please rate and review me on iTunes. My name is Mike Elgin. There goes the FatCast.